think for many of us, Christmas and nostalgia go hand in hand. At our home, at least most recently, as the children grow older, I think we spend just as much time talking about Christmas past as we do about the Christmas that is present. I mean, we all try to, at some level, recreate the magic of years gone by. We watch the same movies, play the same soundtracks, what are called playlists now, and try to kind of reset the scene, if at all possible, knowing full well that it doesn't always happen. We don't get the same magic that we maybe have had in years past as much as we may desire it. I mean, there is something about Christmas nostalgia that is both magical and quite depressing. I mean, one of the leading causes, statistically speaking, of depression during the holidays is a longing for holidays past. I mean, whether it was before, you know, the family broke down, or you were estranged from that particular child, you know, longing for those days maybe before that one person in the family passed away, or a desire to be back in a certain place, celebrating in a certain way that is no longer home, or just that general reality that things change, kids grow up, you can't go back, and those kind of things pain us as we consider or at least get nostalgic about the holiday season. I mean, it's interesting that the word nostalgia is actually a Greek word where we get our word homesickness from. The same pain that drives many of us into forms of depression during the holiday season is the same thing that drives us, you know, to look at old family photos, drive by that old house you used to live in, or look up friends from days gone by, a desire to be back to a time and a place where you're known and loved and feel safe. And what is noteworthy is that nostalgia or homesickness, this ache, has been shown to kind of lie in the heart of every human being. It really is universal. What the philosopher George Lukacs called transcendental homelessness. He would write in his philosophy that it drives every good story, every good novel has this same basic premise that there is somebody who is lost and is seeking to return home and has that desire that really drives them to move a story forward. I think even if you don't agree with him literarily, you have to agree with him experientially. To be human, at least at this point in history, is to know the pain of paradise lost. And with that, to have a brief and flinting recollection that there was something better at some time, some joy that can't quite be found again. While it may be felt acutely during the holidays, of course, it can rear its head at any time. And I think the most troubling manifestations, at least in my own experience, aren't at the worst moments or these times when you're longing for something that was better. I think the hardest part is when it rears its head in the best moments. I mean, have you ever sat around a table with family and friends enjoying an experience and then at the same time, kind of at the bottom of it all, there's this low-grade feeling of emptiness or loneliness that these kind of things just can't quite do the heavy lifting that you would like them to do? It's the same feeling you get after that long-awaited vacation. And there you are. You thought that this would be the time of your life. And, you know, the same arguments and the same problems and the same anxieties go with you. Or that thing that you bought that you felt that you just had to have and you receive it, and it just doesn't quite scratch the itch. As Chesterton put it, men are homesick in their homes. What I found fascinating about reading on this topic is that homesickness used to be something that was diagnosed by physicians, like literally causing physical symptoms, even to the point where there's noted, you know, deaths that come from someone longing to be back home, probably something a little more realistic at a time when people really were making larger moves, and yet there really are these noted realities of pain that cause even sufferers to refuse to eat, eventually die of weakness, and even induce fevers and sores and so forth. While it may no longer be a medical diagnosis in our time, we have yet been able to rid ourselves from the disease. I mean, why is it? Why is there this universal ache? I mean, why this longing for home, even if you hated the home in which you grew up in? I mean, have you ever met those people that had a horrible home life, but there's this knowledge and this desire for something that they perceive to be what it would be like to have a home that was welcoming? And they have a great desire, especially if they go on to get married and have a family, to recreate or to create something they never had, but that they could imagine all life long. We all know at some deep but visceral level that this is somehow, as Julian Barnes put it, a rented world, that things are transient here. But maybe worse, not only is it a transient world, that at some level it's an inhospitable world. I mean, even in our world of roads and running water and refrigerated food and all the technology we could want, we know that this world is not kind to us in the long run. We, like the cast of Cheers, are dying for a place where we can just belly up at the bar and everyone will not only know our name, they'll always be glad we came, but we want that to be something that we know will be there tomorrow and every day after that. And we realize that this world just doesn't offer us that reality, at least not in some way we can fully get our hands around. And that was what our text this morning wants to address and hopefully alleviate. I want us to see this morning in Isaiah chapter 35, first, a new place. A new place. You see it in verses 1 and 2, and then in the second half of verses 6 and 7. This text opens with a stark transformation. There's this desert, a wasteland, that somehow becomes this lush garden. I mean, you know, the language really is the language of shocking reversal. The deserted places have become glad places. You can't help but hear the ringing and repeated reality of gladness and joy and rejoicing and singing. And why all of this singing? Why is the land itself bursting out in song? Because it has finally been transformed. You'll notice the desert is blooming abundantly. Water has broken forth that causes everything to grow. The sand has become a pool. The desert floor is literal springs of water, so much so that where there was formerly dead grass, there are reeds and rushes, you know, the sorts of things that grow up around lakes and rivers. And says the desert is just full of all of these things. And then there's this comparison that we don't get because we're not from there. It says, you know, it's like Lebanon and Carmel and Sharon. It's hard for us to get it because we don't know the topography well of ancient Israel. But what they're trying to talk to us about is places that are renowned for their lushness. Lebanon in particular was a mountainous place, but it was a mountainous place that didn't only have wonderfully large trees, it also was inhabited by all sorts of wild creatures that would feed there because they could all find food, and it produced for people olives and grapes and figs, you know, all the things that are necessary for the good life, from olive, olives come both olive oil and gladness, but wine produced from the grapes and sweetness from the figs. There's all these good things that come from the land. And they would hear these words, and it would be like us hearing, you know, Death Valley became like Napa Valley. Or, you know, Hesperia becomes like the Redwood Forest. And if you've ever been through Hesperia, you know exactly what I'm talking about. This odd transformation where places that you would never want to have to live necessarily, especially before running water and electricity, have become places where everyone would want to be because they are so full of life and life-giving realities. Notice what was formerly under the groan in this text is all rejoicing. And it's put in this reality where the creation itself is rejoicing. A world that was under the curse, right, that has now been banished to produce thorns and thistles, when it wanted, if you will, to work along with man and to give him everything he needed, this world is under this groan, but not at this point in history. It's all reversed. And the things that it was intended for, things that bring joy to man, are flourishing in its midst. But not only is there a new place, you'll notice in verses 3 and 4, there's a new people. This new place, if you will, brings about, oddly, a renewed people. You see that in some of the way that the text tells itself. We find these people in our text who are first worn out. People who have been ravaged by living in places like we see in the first two verses before they were changed. We see in the final verses of the text they were sighing and they were full of sorrow. But in the beginning of this text, they have, weak hands and feeble knees. And we We don't know what those things mean. But what it's saying is, you know, the kind of living that happens in tough places has borne its result on these people. You ever seen the reality of people who live in hard places become hard people? Or at least tough places become tough people. You know, you can tell people that have been raised kind of in the lap of luxury versus those who had to do hard things their whole life. And you don't know it just by conversation. You can know it by looking at them, right? There is something that comes with the wear and tear of hard living that does its damage to the human constitution. And these people in this text are worn out by the difficulty of life that has come from living in places that were inhospitable to them, that were not kind to them. You know, they were ravaged by the heat, ravaged by years of famine, the difficulty that comes with trying to, you know, grow crops in a place that will not give them to you easily or kindly. These people, having been living in the wilderness, a place without water, limited resources, and the frightening beasts that go with it all, are weakened by it. Their hands are weak. Their knees are shaky. They're full of fears and stress and anxiety. But notice they're also physically compromised. As the text goes on, we find these people who are blind and lame and deaf and mute. All things, of course, that are physically limiting. But scripturally speaking, these aren't just physical ailments. There's a result that comes with being blind or lame or being mute that you can't even enter, not just into your full humanity, you can't enter into the presence of God according to the Levitical law, right? There's this uncleanness that comes with you being unwhole. Because you aren't completely human, if you will, you're not human in its best, in its fullest form, you are not welcomed into the presence of God. They are blemished, if you will, and therefore cannot approach the holy places. So we have this physically haggard people who are also spiritually unfit. And into this situation springs joy, literally. Springs and joy. Yeah, anyway. There's this turnaround because the whole world turns. Notice, for, why are they rejoicing? Because water breaks forth in the wilderness. Because this whole world is transformed before their eyes, because the desert becomes a garden, all of a sudden, humanity is renewed and refreshed, and they begin to mimic the world in which they inhabit it. They begin to rejoice, just like the land was rejoicing in their midst. They have everlasting singing and gladness and no more sorrow or sighing. I mean, if that's what this text is telling us, that there's this new world, a new place with a new people, we also see that there must be a new way in order for this to be a reality. As you read this text, I don't know about you, but something about it just, it makes me happy. You know, you read these things and you think, yeah, that's what I want. Whatever that is, that's what I want for my own existence. And it creates in us, hopefully, a longing. But the reality is we haven't experienced this. Right? We get little tastes of something like this, right? We've been to beautiful places. We've had good days. But the idea of all of the hard things being removed and all of the broken things being fixed, that's a reality that we somehow can relate to, though we've never experienced it firsthand. Our world, the world in which we have entered into, our lives have always had a bit of brokenness, right? There's always shadows at least lurking in the corners. And though we've never experienced this, deep down we know we want it. In fact, deep down, we know we've lost it, and we want it back. I mean, that idea that we talked about in the introduction, this reality of this, you know, transcendental homelessness, is something that resides in every human being. And a lot of these authors that I was quoting, these aren't Christian authors trying to come up with Advent sermons. These are philosophers trying to explain what does it mean to be a human, and why do we all have this same deep down, bone-rooted experience where we feel lost even in the midst of our most settled moments. Because we have been lost, right? We were all there, if you will, in Adam, knowing what it was like to live in the presence of God with a world that was giving you what you needed and beyond that, exceeding just your needs, giving you everything you wanted without any of the downside that comes in this particular existence. We know we lost it, and we know at some level we want it back, but we have no idea humanly speaking, how to get there. I mean, our text tells us this in verse 10. You'll notice all of this is about a return. It says, when will all this happen? Well, when the Lord returns His people. You know, this text comes to us in the midst of Isaiah, where the people are being told that they're about to be banished into exile and they will live in the deserted places in the earth. And when they go to these deserted places, they will be the dregs of society. They will not be loved or beloved where they're at, and they will experience the hardships that come with not only being in inhospitable places topographically, but in inhospitable places socially. You will not be loved by the people that take over your kingdom. And in the midst of that, Isaiah 35 just drops in out of nowhere that there's going to come this moment where there's streams in the desert, where there's rejoicing in the whole created order, where man is brought back in cleanliness, and he comes. And when does all this happen? When he comes back in return, when God brings him back to the nation of Israel. I mean, this text is about return because the whole Bible really is about the story of return. Whether it be from Israel to the promised land or return for Adam back to an Edenic setting, the reality is all of the Bible is about a return for humanity to where they were intended to be. And we can all resonate, hopefully, with this text and hopefully have a longing for it, because the bottom line is we're all victims of the parts of this text that are being reversed, right? We've all lived in the deserted places. We all know what it means to be the unclean ones. We've all experienced the pains that come not only with the physical ailments of this life, but the spiritual ailments that plague us all and the results and the fallout thereof. I mean, all those wonderful nostalgic memories of Christmas oftentimes blot out the ones where you were, you know, cursing in the garage or upset with a family member or somehow became more estranged from the family you were seeking to reunite through the holiday season. The reality is this whole place is broken, and we are broken people in the midst of it, and we would want something like Isaiah 35 to come and interrupt our world and to give us something better in return. And the story of the wilderness and broken people is the story not only of Israel, but of our very life. Our lives testify to this truth. We broke the world, and now the world breaks us. And it won't always, according to this text, be like this. Because there's going to come a day when that's all in the past, a faint memory of which you will have no nostalgia. And it happens, according to the text, when God arrives. When you see that, it happens both times. When the world is made new when God arrives. They shall see the glory of the Lord and rejoice. When will the wilderness rejoice? When God's glory is presented before it. Notice, when will the new people rejoice? He says, don't fear, don't be anxious. Why? Behold your God. Look, God's here arriving on your behalf. It will happen when God arrives and a new path is made. You see that in the text. There will be this highway, this way of holiness. Notice on this way of holiness, there's people who can't be there. There's no unclean people on it. There's no dangerous animals allowed on it. But there are these people who are allowed. They're the redeemed and the ransomed. Even, thankfully, if they're fools. And whether you can see it or not, this is the story of Advent, the very story of Christmas. And the arrival of God to make a new world and to renew a people. And there's a reason that you love Joy to the World. And if you don't, you should. You know, no more let, you know, thorns grow or infest the ground, you know, all the sorrow and sighing, we want to flee away. You know, this reality that we don't want thorns to infest the ground and the curse being reversed, all of those things we're singing about are being sung about because Isaac Watts and others understood Isaiah 35, that the coming of Christ really is the beginning of this reality. The arrival of God is to make a new world, and Jesus doesn't even try to hide it. You'll notice when John the Baptist in our text this morning from Matthew 11 finds himself in prison, you know, and he's read Isaiah 35, and he knows he's a prophet, and he's like, okay, you said you're the Messiah. Where is all this good stuff, you know? When are the bad guys going to get their comeuppance, and when are the good guys going to be set free? Because here I am, you know, not only your family member, but the guy who was preparing everybody for your arrival, and I'm in prison, you know, what gives? And Jesus says, go and tell John. The blind see, the lame walk. You know, the poor have the good news preached to them. What's he saying? He's saying, Isaiah 35 is happening right now. Tell John not to be offended because of me. Which also says something about the arrival of God, that it causes some strange offense. I mean, what gives if Christ comes to make all things new, and yet somehow those who are on his side still find themselves imprisoned or in bondage, like John, to the ways of this world? And I'm sure you have felt that angst. You probably haven't articulated it quite as smoothly as John did. But the reality of, like, I've done this for you, Lord, and this is what you've done for me. I mean, this is the lot in life that you're giving me at this present time. You know, why believe in you if all of these same sorts of things happen to us, you know? Why does death intrude into our lives, or heartbreak and addiction and all these other things that we thought we were in one sense escaping by coming to this new reality that you promised? Where is the salvation that you've come to give? When we feel broken by the world, but as we've already mentioned, the fact is we broke the world. And for Christ to bring this vision of Isaiah 35 to pass, a world made new with people made new, he has to fix the breakers, you know? That if the world is ravaged because of us who ravaged it, he has to come and deal with that problem before he can resolve the other things that we so long for. And of course, he does it in the most outrageous way. He does it as a God who leaves his rightful home to be born in a stable and gives himself so fully in love to his people that while the animals he created have places to sleep, this one, the God of all creation, has no place to lay his head, no home at all in the earth that he has made. A God whose desire for the restoration of life and the return of his people to their home is so great that he will give up his own life outside the gate, becoming an outcast and a vagabond, a byword on the earth itself, so that he can say to us even this morning, in my Father's house, there are many rooms. And if it were not true, I would have told you, but I go to make a home for you. A place where you will actually be received and welcomed. He left his home in order to bring all of us homesick travelers to a place of final and true belonging. But to get us there, he had to deal with what was blocking the way for us to arrive. Our own sin and misery, and the misery that it causes. I mean, our history of poor choices, and then our complaints about the consequences from the choices we've made, we could not find the way. And so he came and became the way and the truth and the life. Notice this highway of holiness is none other than Christ himself. You'll notice it's a strange thing. No unclean people can be found there. But he says, only people who have been redeemed, people who have been reconciled, and fools, they're allowed on there. It just doesn't seem that you could have all those groups together. I thought there were no unclean people, and yet how is it that redeemed people can be on there? Ransomed people. What kind of people do you need to redeem and ransom? Well, those who have been cast off and who've become under the bondage of others, which is what's happening in the book of Isaiah. Israel is being cast off because of her own choices, and God is coming to save her from herself. And he does so by laying down his own life and becoming the way in which we may walk. By making us holy, not by first changing us and then receiving us, but by gifting to us what we could never give to him. A holy life in our stead, and a death to buy us back from all the bad decisions we've made. So that fools like us who cannot read a map to save our lives won't get lost on the way home. I know the time here in this present age can be tough, but at the end of the day, when that final sun sets, we will be home. And until that day, we'll never be free from our homesickness. I mean, I remember I used to, maybe you weren't U2 fans in your youth. Some of you are so young, you probably don't know who U2 is, which is a sad, sad state of affairs. My first cassette, because that's what we were listening to back then. Thankfully, U2 was played on the local Christian station, and since I was not allowed to buy secular albums, they qualified as Christian, so that was one of my first albums ever. But maybe you'll remember what Bono sings when he says, you know, I believe in the kingdom come, when all the colors will bleed into one. And he talks about that he has faith in those. He says, you know, I believe it, but I still haven't found what I'm looking for. I used to listen to that and just think, what does he mean? I mean, if he's found Jesus and he's found the kingdom, how can he say in the same breath that he still hasn't found what he's looking for? Because we haven't. We won't have found fully what we're looking for until this day comes, when we finally arrive home and we're made whole. Maybe you've seen it the way that it's summed up in the last battle when the unicorn finally steps onto the ground of the kingdom. And he says, I've come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I've been looking for my whole life, though I never knew it until now. The reason why we loved the old Narnia is that sometimes it looked a little like this. In the meantime, as we wait for that day when we step on that final new creation, may the joy of what Christ has already done to ensure that we will be found there, even as fools like ourselves, may that spur on both us in the midst of suffering, but it may also may it become the foundation and give us the right to celebrate in the midst of the suffering. Even so, come Lord Jesus. Let us pray.